I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And our conversation today is with a brain doctor who says her own devastating stroke was a form of nirvana. But first, Wall Street analysts are circulating lists of more troubled banks today after yesterday's failure of the California-based IndyMac Bancorp. In a press conference this morning, President Bush had this response when asked about bank safety.
The depositor must understand that the federal government, through the FDIC, stands behind the deposit up to $100,000. And therefore, which leads me to say that if you're a depositor, you're protected by the federal government.
Well, California depositors lined up outside IndyMac Bank branches Monday, withdrawing their money after the bank's assets were seized by the FDIC. It's the largest bank failure since the collapse of Continental Illinois in 1984. David Gaffin of The Wall Street Journal writes that paper's Market Beat blog. David, what do you think of these lists that are circulating? Do you think other banks are vulnerable?
Oh, I think other banks would certainly be vulnerable. The FDIC had even suggested that smaller banks may end up being vulnerable. They were careful yesterday to say that perhaps there would be no other larger banks that would be in trouble, although IndyMac was certainly a large enough bank on its own. I would think that, yeah, there are going to be more issues with other banks.
Have you seen any of these lists?
I've seen a couple of them. They are indeed a number of smaller banks, very much regional or even more local banks, so to speak, and of course because they're exposed to real estate markets that, you know, went through a big boom and now are going through a big bust, that's going to be a problem for them.
ABC News is reporting that banks in Colorado, Maryland, Georgia, and California are on the top of some privately prepared lists of these troubled banks. I mean, as you say, they are regional or smaller banks. When you say small, what do you mean by that? Can you give a number?
There's a number of these that are listed that are banks that just have branches more or less in the state that they originate from. There are many banks that people are referring to that are even smaller than that, that are in, you know, pretty local areas that have, you know, only a handful of branches.
We understand there's a formula that's used to rate banks. It's called the Texas Ratio. Can you briefly explain that and then explain why don't consumers get this information?
The Texas Ratio is something that's very briefly, it's where you take all of the bank's assets and their reserves, that's, you know, the cash that they have on hand, and that compares it to what's called non-performing loans. And non-performing loans are essentially loans that aren't going to be repaid or aren't being repaid, and that could be mortgages or any other type of loan. And it's a good way to sort of judge whether a bank has a lot of loans on its balance sheet or a lot of loans that it's originated that are not going to be repaid by customers. What happens here is that we've seen a massive increase in that, and it's more than the banks expected.
If they have more bad loans than assets, then obviously that's a bad equation. But why is this something that's just circulated on Wall Street? Why isn't this something that's made known to consumers?
Most of the time it's because consumers, at least people who are depositing, let's say, less than $100,000, there's certain provisions where it's less than $250,000, those assets are insured. So that's probably part of the reason why it's less of an issue necessarily.
In other words, don't panic people unnecessarily because they are insured. But you wrote, you know, with all the crises, you know, the bad subprime loans, the investment banks that failed, the homeowners who, you know, can't pay their mortgages, you say, you know, what's next? If the U.S. dollar fails, perhaps the solar system fails next. How bad has this gotten?
It's hard for me to say, only because as a journalist, I sometimes feel like I'm more inclined to be pessimistic than anything else. But this appears to be pretty bad. There are a lot of problems with the system right now. The two gigantic companies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that were out there guaranteeing half of the mortgage debt in the United States are having to be backstopped by the federal government. And I think that we won't see the end of this until the housing market is stable again, and that may take a lot more time because people are not, you know, paying their bills. There are people who are, you know, pulling back on their spending. People have seen their assets, that is the value of their house, have fallen dramatically. And for years, people made money based on the fact that the price of their house went up, and then they then sold it and then, you know, moved on. And this is something that's not happening now, and it's not going to return to a more normal path for some time, I would say. It's not something that corrects itself within a few months. It's going to take a long time.
David Gaffin covers Wall Street for The Wall Street Journal. David, thank you.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Our next guest gets more than 100 emails a day. She's viewed on YouTube 20,000 times a day. She's not an actor or an athlete. She's a stroke survivor who also happens to be a brain scientist. And after Jill Bolte Taylor appeared on Oprah, Fresh Air, and in the New York Times, she became a symbol of hope for stroke victims and religious groups. It all started when, at 37, she lost her mind and gained enlightenment. Dr. Bolte Taylor had a severe brain hemorrhage in the left hemisphere of her brain, the side responsible for ego and logic, language. She couldn't speak or read or walk, but her brain's right lobe, the side responsible for creativity and empathy, took over, and she says she experienced a peace, enlightenment, even, especially, while almost dying. Dr. Bolte Taylor had recovered fully over the course of 8 years and now advocates for stroke victims and the mentally ill. We should mention she became interested in brains in the first place because her brother is schizophrenic. She tells her story in the book My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, and joins us from the public radio station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. Welcome, Dr. Bolte Taylor.
Thank you, Robin. Please call me Jill.
Well, Jill, how are people responding to you? What are you hearing now that your story's out?
People who have experienced stroke are looking at me as I have completely recovered, and if I can do it, then they can do it too. Yeah. And caregivers are looking at the story and saying, well, what advantage did you have? What did you know about the brain that I ought to know in order to help my loved one get better? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, this normal population of people is saying, oh, my gosh, you know, you lost your left hemisphere and you ended up having this experience of euphoria and bliss. How do I get some of that? So it's really been a very positive experience.
Although it's somewhat poignant. I mean, you write about, you know, hearing from a young girl, and I could ask you the same thing, not as young, but, you know, wondering, my loved one had a stroke. What happened? Why didn't they call 911? What happened in that moment? So let's talk about what happened to you. And by the way, you know, we mentioned that you're a brain scientist, a neuroanatomist, which gives you a unique view of what was happening to you. Take us to that chapter, Morning of the Stroke. What happened?
Well, on the morning of December 10, 1996, I woke up and I had a pounding pain behind my left eye. And I thought, okay, I've got a headache going on. I'm going to start my normal routine. So I jumped onto my cardioglider and I'm exercising away on this thing. And I looked at my hands, and my hands looked like primitive claws grasping onto the bar. And I looked down at my body, and my body, I seemed to be separated from the normal perception of reality where I'm the person on the machine having the experience, to some esoteric perspective where I'm witnessing myself having this perspective.
Right.
So I got off the machine, and I noticed immediately that everything inside of my body had slowed way down. And I got into the shower, and I lost my balance in the shower, and I was leaning up against the wall. And the atoms and molecules of my arm seemed to blend in with the atoms and molecules of the wall, and I could no longer define the boundaries of where I began and ended.
You write you felt enfolded by a blanket of tranquil euphoria. At one point,
yeah,
you think, well, this is kind of cool. And there was sort of a seduction to it. That's stunning to me.
It was really beautiful. I no longer had the boundaries of where I began and ended, so I had the sense that I was as big as the universe, and the normal brain chatter that connected me to the external world and anything that in my life that had been stressful was gone. But then periodically, my left hemisphere brain chatter would come back online and essentially shock me back into normal reality.
Right.
But it wasn't until my right arm went totally paralyzed by my side that I realized, oh my gosh, I'm having a stroke. But, you know, through the eyes of a brain scientist, this is like an exhilarating moment in time. It's like, here I have this opportunity to witness the degeneration, the deterioration of my thought processes from the inside out, and what insight that could be into helping the medical community really better understand what is going on inside of the brain.
Okay, I want to hold you up in this compelling story. You know, next you realize you have to, as you said, get help, and that was an excruciating process of trying to figure out how to work a phone again and staring at a phone keypad. But do tell us, though, what was happening in your brain that, for instance, you felt this oneness? It increases as you go through this experience, and you felt, you know, this sense of you don't really have a boundary. You're at one with the world. What is happening in the brain that's helping that to happen?
Well, the left hemisphere is my ability to connect to information that I've brought up from my past and be able to apply that to the present moment in order to project what's going to happen in the future. So when that hemorrhage happened inside of my left hemisphere, it forced the left hemisphere offline, leaving me with just what's going on in the right hemisphere. And so, it was beautiful there.
Beautiful, but also there's a sense of urgency. You know you have to pay attention. I'm reading here. Holding onto the phone was like holding onto a slippery fish, and you're saying to yourself, hold on to the fish, hold on to understanding that this is a phone, hold on for the next moment of clarity. It takes 45 minutes just to figure out who and how to call and how to call for help.
Right.
And then you start matching squiggles on papers to squiggles on phone pads. You're even losing a sense of what a number is, but you feel you could just match it to the keypad. Then what happens?
I finally get the whole number dialed. My colleague answers the phone, and he says to me, "Roar, roar, roar." And I realize, oh, my gosh, he sounds like a golden retriever, and I can't understand what he's saying. And so then I say to him, this is Jill, I need help. But what comes out of my mouth is, "Roar, roar." So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, language is out.
Well, you finally do get to the hospital, several hospitals. You continue to sort of fall into this wonderful void, as you write. You don't have your language center anymore telling you who you are, and so you feel no obligation to be that person. You just are going to be what? What are you at this point? How do you perceive yourself?
I perceive myself as an infant in a woman's body. I was in an absolutely silent mind. It was not communicating to me, my name is Jill, this is where I live, these are the things I like or dislike. Yet I still existed. A little piece of me was still alive and conscious and perceiving. I just had zero language and no skills capable of understanding what others spoke or interacted with me. At the same time, my right hemisphere had natural talents of its own. It could read body language. It could read facial language. It could pick up energy dynamics. Everything was the big picture of context. So I had lost the left hemisphere that's capable of taking the big picture and breaking it apart into the fine details. But I still existed. And from my perspective, even though I couldn't walk, talk, read, write, or have any recollection of my life, I still perceived myself as perfect and whole and beautiful. Everybody else was freaking out, but I was okay.
Well, you say, imagine everything radiates pure energy. With childlike curiosity, your heart soars in peace. Your mind explores new ways of swimming in a sea of euphoria. Then ask yourself, how motivated would you be to come back? Mm-hmm. So did you have to fight a seduction? Did you have to, because your mother comes to care for you. All your friends are there. Many of the doctors know you and are trying to pull you over almost. Is that how it felt, pulling you away from that seduction?
I needed them to seduce me out of this because the euphoria and bliss was a natural space where I really wanted to go. It was pain-free. It was beautiful. So it really had to take people in the external world who loved me gently in order to want to try to reconnect.
That stroke is its survivor, Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor. We're going to have more with her later. The first interrogation tape from Guantanamo Bay will have that as well. But we'll be back in 1 minute here and now. We're back with more from Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, a brain scientist who had a massive, debilitating stroke at age 37, but one that she says produced pure bliss. Now, Jill, you couldn't speak or understand language sometimes, but you felt things around you. For instance, there was that nurse who took care of you in one hospital. Now, you called her an energy vampire because she was so abrupt with you, as if you weren't there. So your story also is a cautionary tale to caregivers. You said you really relied on them, you were just saying, to woo you back from that bliss to the real world.
Exactly. Well, you know, one of my messages, I think, is take responsibility for the energy you bring into any room, much less the room of someone who is ill, because they may not be picking up on anything else, but they may be picking up on your energy. It was real clear to me when somebody didn't want to be there or when someone was totally preoccupied with their to-do list and they were not present and available for me. And if the caregivers were not available for me, then why would I even bother to try?
You'd always been involved with the mentally ill. You're now very involved with stroke victims. How universal was your experience? And, you know, people desperately want to know. I want to know. My mom had a couple of strokes, and she always seemed so frightened. Do you think that your experience, this sort of nirvana, had more to do with you, or what, you know, what are you saying about it?
I think it has to do with the very specific circuitry in the brain that gets disturbed. I was very fortunate that when that circuitry went offline, I felt the experience of nirvana or euphoria. I've had lots of emails from people who have said, you have described my experience beautifully. Thank you for putting words to it. I've had other emails from other individuals who have pretty clearly defined themselves as having problems with their right hemisphere, and they haven't had that experience at all. And perhaps what has happened is they've lost the big picture, which I gained, and they now get caught up in the left hemisphere details. And the details are much more difficult. You know, that's part of your stress circuitry. And if all I'm running is my stress circuitry, then I can't find relief.
Well, and, you know, people have said that you had not a left hemisphere experience, but a religious experience. And you've been asked to appear on radio and TV programs by people who claim to see angels. And how do you feel about being so embraced by those believers?
You know, to me, it's all about semantics. We all use different language for different things. Somebody who's comfortable with the phrase God uses God to describe something. But for me, it's circuitry. And I just really don't get at all hung up on the language. I'm just glad, really, that people are talking about their brains. They're open to the possibility that perhaps we really are wired for this peacefulness. And boy, if more of us hooked into that wiring, then we would be feeling and experiencing more of that peace and projecting that into the world.
Well, on the other hand, while some have wanted to embrace you as some sort of representation of some enlightenment and sort of elevate you in that way, there are others who have been very critical of you, who've said, this is brain damage, and this is just, you know, confusion. And some people have said the same feeling can be achieved through drugs, you know, the brain. And, you know, to assign it to sort of a euphoria or a nirvana, which to some means some sort of transcendence, is inaccurate.
Right. Well, you know, I think everybody's got an opinion. It's the beauty of the left hemisphere. It's part of how we're wired. And I think that the left hemisphere has a tendency to want to ridicule. There's some actually scathing reports out there. And you know, that's a group of cells in your brain. That was a group of cells that wanted to come back online in my brain. And I said, no, I don't need that little mean voice anymore.
You know, I feel I should ask you more directly, because you've been talking about how the science of this. Do you think you had a religious experience? Do you think you glimpsed God? Do you think that's what part of that euphoria was?
I think that what happened in my brain was I lost part of the circuitry in my left hemisphere.
Yep.
And I had this experience. It felt like euphoria to me. I felt that I was at one with all that is. And to think that you know, I can track a moving target through space only because I have cells that perform that function. Or I can recognize someone by their face only because I have cells that perform that function. And perhaps our ability as a people to experience God or to be at one with whatever it is and whatever you want to call it is through that specific circuitry, then great. But I view it all as circuitry. And because of the circuitry, we have the capacity for what we are as living beings.
Well, from a fetal position in your apartment to major surgery to a long, long recovery process to here you are back. Do you miss that place you were, that euphoria, even though you were in the flesh immobile?
No, I don't really, because I never had to give it up. And I think that one of the things about circuitry is, you know, whatever you focus your mind on is that circuitry. And the more you think about those thoughts and the more you run that circuit, then the stronger those circuits become. And so for me, I had 5 full weeks of just this pure right hemisphere experience of euphoria. And I got to bring it along with me through the process of recovery. I got to add new things to it, but that didn't take away from my ability to say, but that's just circuitry. I don't have to think those thoughts anymore.
Yeah, but as you wrote, you know, it was a place when you lost the old Jill where you weren't even conscious of your parents' divorce, which had been painful. And now you're back in that world where you are conscious of those things. I mean, are you just saying that you've brought some of that ability to transcend some of those things back with you? Is that?
No, I never reopened all those files. All of that emotional baggage was gone.
Huh.
And so, yes, I learned that my parents were divorced, but none of the triggers were there anymore.
Wow.
So I got to be essentially have a new birth and begin again, and I didn't have to go back to the old person. I didn't have to go back to her likes or dislikes. I didn't have to go back to her emotional baggage. It's really been an incredible opportunity to come back into the world as an adult with a whole new attitude.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, do you stumble across someone who says, you know, you realize they're being a little tentative and, you know, it's because you had a fight or something, and you don't have, as you said, you don't have that memory of angst. Have you come across old friends who need to tell you what some of your background is or with them?
Well, I had one person contact me and say, you know, I know we went separate ways on bad terms and I'd like to make up for that. And I wrote back and said, you know, I'm sorry, I don't remember. So, you know, to me, we're at peace.
You know, the funny thing is, I just got an email like that from a friend in high school, and I didn't have a stroke, and I don't remember it either. So,
exactly. You don't have to hold on to that stuff.
Well, it's just fascinating. That's Dr. Jill Bolte-Taylor, brain scientist, author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey, and now an advocate for others who have had strokes. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, still ahead, that New Yorker cover, here and now. A newly released video is giving the first glimpse into interrogations at Guantanamo Bay. It's also raising questions about treatment of one of the youngest detainees there. The tape shows then 16-year-old Omar Khadr breaking down, holding his head, sobbing. It's difficult to hear. There's a fan running, but his lawyers say he's crying out, "Help me." Khadr, a Canadian citizen raised by fundamentalist parents in Afghanistan, was captured in Afghanistan in 2002 when he was 15. He's accused of throwing a grenade that killed a U.S. soldier during a firefight and spying for and providing material support to terrorists. The video shows him being questioned by Canadian agents working with U.S. authorities. With us from Alberta, Canada, Colin Freeze of the Toronto Globe and Mail. Colin, how are Canadians reacting to this tape?
I think in Canada, we've been following this case quite closely for some time. The public's been very curious to know about, the lifetime odyssey of Omar Khadr in Afghanistan, and now the legal odyssey in Guantanamo Bay over the last 6 years. This is the first time we've had a chance to see him in a video in Guantanamo Bay. The lawyers have released it in hopes of building public sympathy for his case. Whether that happens is yet to be determined.
Well, this is just sort of a highlight, if you will, an edited reel that was released by his lawyers. There are 7 more hours of tape expected to be released later today. Just remind us, how did the tape come to be released? How did the lawyers get it?
Well, this was the result of a series of court decisions. Basically, Canada has a Charter of Rights and Freedoms that gives Canadian citizens very strong civil liberties protections. And his lawyers basically argued that because they have no faith in the Guantanamo Bay process, they should be entitled to Canadian records concerning Canadian-led interrogations of Omar Khadr because it could conceivably assist in his defense. And in the latter stages of these legal arguments, which went to our Supreme Court, my newspaper and other media organizations supported this. We wanted to try for the tapes, too, not to support Omar Khadr or to not support him, but simply we wanted to see inside Guantanamo Bay.
Well, the federal judge in Canada who ordered that the tapes be turned over to the lawyers also said that it appears that the Canadian officials who traveled to Guantanamo Bay to do the interrogation violated international human rights laws. Let's listen to a little more of the tape. It's very difficult to hear, again, because there's a fan turned on in the room. But Khadr initially thinks that these Canadian agents are there to help him, and then he realizes that they are the interrogators. Let's listen.
You don't care about me, that's what...
Well, I do care about you, but I want to talk to the honest Omar that I was talking to yesterday. I don't want to talk to this Omar.
It wasn't honest.
Yes, it was.
You see, you're not going to believe me.
Well, look me straight in the eyes and tell me that you're being honest.
I am being honest.
Omar, you can't even bear to look at me when you're saying that.
Again, Omar Khadr says, "You don't care about me." It's difficult to watch. This is a young boy, but... does it show any violations of international human rights laws, as the Canadian judge says? Does it show any torture or even mistreatment?
You know, Guantanamo Bay doesn't pass muster with Canada's notions of what is legal rights and due process. In the footage that's released today, there was no abuse. This is not waterboarding. It is a rather aggressive questioning of a teenage suspect in Guantanamo Bay. But I'm told that, you know, our spy service and even your State Department isn't entirely displeased because it shows a police style interrogation. It's not waterboarding. It's nothing of that caliber. But there is documents that were released last week that show that, you know, U.S. military officials did soften Mr. Cotter up for subsequent interviews by using something that the Pentagon calls its frequent flyer program. The idea is that you take a detainee, you make him move every 3 hours to a different cell. It basically amounts to sleep deprivation, and it's something that our judges weren't okay with.
He also says on the tape, he pulls his orange jumpsuit off his chest and shows many wounds that he received from the firefight, from the initial firefight where he was captured, and he says he hadn't been treated medically. Do we know whether or not he was treated medically?
I don't think it was ever a question of him not getting any treatment. It was always a question of him getting adequate treatment. And some of these issues continue to affect Omar Cotter today. He was shot three times in the chest and neck area. He was very nearly killed about 6 months before those interviews that everybody's now seeing were taking place. And you know, to his credit, to their credit, the American soldiers who encountered him on the battlefield did bring him back from death's door. But these were very serious wounds, and of course, a lot for a 15-year-old boy to suffer and recover from.
Well, what do we know about the charges against him following that firefight where he was captured? He was charged with throwing the grenade that killed an American soldier, but secret documents were mistakenly released to reporters at Gitmo saying there was another foreign fighter found alive that day. So this 15-year-old, Omar Cotter, may not have thrown that grenade.
Yeah, that's all threw us for a loop. It went in the winter because for the longest time, and again, we're talking about events that occurred 6 years ago. Omar Cotter's now 21. That the theory always, that and nobody ever challenged it, was that Omar Cotter was the sole survivor of this battle. And then all of a sudden we're hearing about a second combatant who may have, you know, it certainly could be used by Mr. Cotter's lawyers to establish reasonable doubt, or they will certainly argue that there's no hard evidence that that he threw the grenade. In any event, I mean, he's heading towards trial at Guantanamo. He's still charged with the murder of an American soldier, Sergeant First Class Christopher Speer. And as you said, the spying and other war crimes that in the U.S. legal regime at Guantanamo Bay is allegedly illegal under U.S. laws.
Well, and one last thought. There were documents released from the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs showing that U.S. soldiers holding Cotter believed that he was essentially a good kid who was salvageable and that if he stayed in custody, he might be radicalized. Will those thoughts be entered into the trial?
There's no question the kid was born into a radical family. He's a Canadian citizenship, but his father was an Egyptian-born al-Qaeda member who more or less sent him off into battle. What there may have been an opportunity lost. I mean, this you know, you can believe Omar Cotter's a villain, you can believe he's a victim, but, you know, a 15-year-old kid in you know, the United States would be in high school and, you know, spend 4 years going through high school, then into university. He spent 6 years in Guantanamo Bay, the same sort of phase of life. So, you know, except he's been exposed to some, you know, people have always suggested Gitmo was built for the worst of the worst, and there is some of that there. So, you know, there are fairly clear accounts of, you know, other prisoners saying, you know, kid, hold your head up. You killed an American soldier. You're going to be a martyr. You'll go to heaven forever. I mean, I don't think this is a very positive message for him to be hearing. It'll be interesting to see if he, you know, has been brainwashed there and how, if he is, how he can be deprogrammed.
Colin Freese of the Toronto Globe and Mail, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, he's 24, he's white, Jewish, from a suburb of Boston, and Rolling Stone says Eli Paperboy Reed is one of America's up-and-coming soul singers. We'll hear why. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. The internet is still buzzing about that New Yorker magazine cover cartoon, the one that depicts Barack Obama as a Muslim, his wife as an armed 60s militant. Artist Barry Blitt drew the cartoon to illustrate an article titled The Politics of Fear, and New Yorker editor David Remnick said it was meant to satirize the right-wing attacks on the Obamas. But the Obama and McCain campaigns both called the cover tasteless and offensive, and blogger Ta-Nehisi Coates has an opinion as well. We spoke with Ta-Nehisi recently about his memoir, The Beautiful Struggle, his story of growing up African-American in Baltimore. He joins us now. And Ta-Nehisi, what is your take on the cartoon?
I don't think it's offensive or tasteless. I do think it's bad satire, though. I don't think it's a particularly effective cartoon. But I think people who are running around saying that this was intentional, or they're trying, New Yorker of all places is trying to propagate this myth about Barack Obama, I think that's quite wrong. I don't think the cartoon was particularly effective. I saw David Remnick defending it, you know, saying that it was satire and, you know, that it was like the Colbert Report. And, you know, it definitely was an attempt at satire. I'm sure it was an attempt at what Stephen Colbert does, but it wasn't done particularly well.
Well, why? Now, let's tell people more about it, although I'm sure people have heard. But it basically depicts Barack Obama with some sort of turban, you know, indicating he is Muslim. His wife, Michelle Obama, is dressed like a 1970s Black Power advocate. They're doing the hand bump. In the background, you can slightly see a portrait of Osama bin Laden.
The flags in the fireplace. They touched on all bases. The only problem is that's what people already think. You know, that is the myth. And so satire works, you know, with exaggeration. I mean, the example I use on my blog is Stephen Colbert, you know, does, when he's imitating a right-wing talk show host, he does his threat down and he lists bears. But no one believes that right-wing talk show hosts are actually threatened by bears, but it's his way of satirizing their view on the environment. So it's very hard to exaggerate what people already think about Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. I'm not saying it couldn't be done, but the satire doesn't simply reflect. That's not enough.
Well, interestingly, I had friends say to me, oh, geez, have you heard about this magazine cover? They didn't even realize that it was the New Yorker magazine, which, as you said, would not be likely to do that. They thought it was a right-wing magazine,
right,
and they didn't see it as satire. They thought it was real.
Right. Yeah. No, I just think it's bad. It's badly done.
Well, by the way, do you think also that it's just going to go away, or is it going to be fodder for people who do think that?
I think it's going to have minimal impact.
Really? Because on your blog, I thought I read that you thought it was going to show up on T-shirts.
It probably will show up on T-shirts, but I guess I'm talking about in terms of voting and stuff like that. I mean, Barack Obama has had worse things on T-shirts. I mean, there was a Curious George thing. I think that's a lot worse than anything the New Yorker did. But I think ultimately, if you were the sort of person who this was going to decide your vote against Barack Obama, you probably weren't going to vote for Barack Obama anyway.
Well, you mentioned the Curious George thing. This is the depiction of Barack Obama as a monkey.
Yeah.
We did a story on this. And, you know, people have said, well, wait a second. George Bush is depicted as a Curious George. It's a caricature. It's satire. Isn't there sort of a goose and gander thing here? Isn't, if it's okay for George Bush, why isn't it okay for Barack Obama?
I have not seen the George Bush illustration, so I can't really comment on that. But I think given the history of, you know, depicting African-Americans as apes, I think that's a little different.
Well, what about other satirization? You know, critics of John McCain, for instance, there are some, they are on the far left, but they have said, for instance, that they don't believe he was really tortured. If someone did a cartoon that showed John McCain, let's say, having a cocktail at the Hanoi Hilton instead of being tortured, and they did it as a way of satirizing people who really didn't believe he was tortured, would that be equally ineffective for you?
See, the thing is it funny? Like, I'm from the Sarah Silverman School. I mean, if it's funny, you know, I'd love to see it. Not so much that I think people should be hands off of Barack Obama, that, you know, people shouldn't, you know, go after him and satirize him and do whatever. I think they most definitely should, but, you know, do it well. That's all I'm saying. Just do it well.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of The Beautiful Struggle, A Father, Two Sons, and An Unlikely Road to Manhood. We highly recommend that book, by the way. But he speaks to us about the controversy over the New Yorker magazine cover that depicts Barack Obama as a Muslim, his wife as a 70s sort of Black Power activist, which, by the way, your father was.
My father was, although he never carried a gun like that or had an afro that big or boots that high.
Ta-Nehisi, thanks for speaking with us.
All right, thank you.
Well, there are plenty of critics of the New Yorker cover, but professional art critics, they're a dying breed, as we'll hear next, Here and Now. Where have all the critics gone? We don't mean those of you who email us with helpful suggestions. We mean movie critics, dance critics, music critics, book critics, who used to be employed across the country by newspapers. Our next guest says that last year, newspapers eliminated the jobs of 121 journalists who held staff positions as art critics, and those 121 jobs disappeared from a pool of only about 1,200 art critic jobs nationwide. That's a 10% industry-wide cut. Deborah Jowett, who wrote about dance for The Village Voice in New York City, is one of the most prominent cuts. She was let go in March after writing for that newspaper for 40 years. The hemorrhaging has gotten so bad that this month the Music Critics Association of North America wrote to several newspapers arguing that having critics on staff covering music is as important as having reporters cover athletic or town hall events. Well, joining us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle is Doug McLennan, a former critic who founded and now runs ArtsJournal.com. He calls that a daily digest of arts news. Doug, you started ArtsJournal.com in 1991. Were you shown the door, or did you go find a door?
Not at all. I actually had a pretty great job as a columnist for the Post-Intelligencer. And I happened to be going through lots of websites at the time and found a story about the Barnes Collection in Philadelphia.
Sure.
And it was a major story. And I didn't know about it. And I thought, gee, there are probably lots of stories around out there that I don't know about. And if you could put them all together, you'd have a pretty interesting daily read.
This was the major arts collection in Philadelphia that they were thinking of moving, and a lot of controversy around it, and a big story here on the East Coast. New to you.
Right.
And so you, some would say lucky you, because do you think your job would have lasted?
I think it would. You know, there are still critics employed by the local paper here in Seattle, but they're falling like flies. We've lost in Seattle four longtime major critics here, and their policy at both papers at this point is anybody who leaves won't be replaced.
Why is this happening? What's going on?
I think you need to look at the larger world of journalism right now. The business model that has supported newspapers in America for the last 50 years really doesn't work anymore. There's no longer the base of ad support to support the kinds of staffs that it takes to run a newspaper.
I can hear listeners saying, well, wait a second, what's the problem here? I feel I get more than enough information about Britney and the TV show Lost. The people who are being let go are the fine arts.
That's actually not true,
no?
Interestingly enough. The biggest losses of critics have been the movie critics and the TV critics.
Huh.
And the reason for that is that they think that they can buy syndicated material. The stuff you can't replace is the local stuff. And so the art critic, the theater critic are really actually the last to go.
Huh, that's interesting. And you're saying this is what you're seeing across the country?
Absolutely. I mean, the ironic thing here is that we're not really talking about the content. More people are reading newspapers today than ever have. The audience for newspapers, the readership for newspapers, is probably about double now on a daily basis than it was 10 years ago. The problem is that the vast majority of that audience now is online, and there isn't yet a business model that supports ads in the same way that you can sell print ads. And the newspaper industry has been pathetically slow at adapting to changing its business model. So it's a failure of business rather than of journalism.
Well, and you've made a transition to online. We understand you comb through English language newspapers for art stories and on a daily basis post about 200 of them. You've started hosting about 52 bloggers, some of them high-profile former critics. If you say newspapers haven't been able to make their business model work, how does your site work? How do you make money?
You know, when I first started it, I thought that it would be one killer thing that would, you know, make me a lot of money doing it. And probably about 3 months after I started the site, I got a buyout offer for $1 million, believe it or not. But that was in the middle of the tech boom. And had I taken that, the site would long ago have disappeared because everybody went out of business in the bust.
You'd be the art version of pets.com.
Exactly. I don't want to be a sock puppet.
Right. That's what you'd be.
What it's turned out to be in reality, however, is that the income comes from a variety of streams. There have been periods where providing content to other websites has been incredibly lucrative, and other times where there's just no market for that. And advertising. We also have subscriptions to newsletters that people pay for. Our material appears on other websites. So between all of them, it works out pretty well.
Are you able to pay the bloggers?
We're actually about to start doing that. The problem with blogs is that they don't by themselves perhaps generate enough income to have a large pool of advertisers. But my sense is that if we network a number of like blogs together, that then you expand the number of advertisers. And so the bloggers will get the revenue from that.
Hmm. But I'm wondering if something is really lost if arts criticism moves online. Because one of the beauties of having articles in a newspaper is, you might have a child who's reading the sports section, but he opens an art section and he sees something he never would see before. You might, I would see something looking through an art section that I would never see, just because it's there and there's a picture and I'm attracted to it.
That's true, and that's an interesting debate to kind of have. Except that I think that you find that particularly among younger people, they're used to stumbling over all sorts of things. You know, in the traditional world, in bricks and mortar record stores, classical music never accounted for more than 3% generally of sales, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that when iTunes opened up, that the percentage of people who were buying classical music suddenly on iTunes was 12%.
Huh.
Being online, it's so much easier to browse and find things that it's exactly that function that you just described, is the stumbling across things and trying it out. Makes it very easy to try something without any investment at all.
But Doug McLennan, we're seeing fewer critics at newspapers and in television stations. Are we seeing the beginning of the end of art criticism?
No. Actually, I think that the system that we've had for the last 50 years has not been terribly good. I think that arts journalism has been a sort of minimally functional model for most of the country. And the reality is that as the audience gets access to more and more and more things, the amazing thing that the web has done is made almost everything accessible to everybody. What's the complaint you hear more than anything else? It's too much. I can't cope with it. I can't find all the things that I want, and there's just too much. So in that sense, the classic role of the critic has been to walk the perimeter, define whatever the topic is, and then come back and say, this is the most important thing over here. Here's something new over here. And by the way, here's how it all interacts with one another. Here's the context of it. And as the access to content expands, the need for critics is going to be more and more. So I think actually that even though this is a very painful transition from one model that doesn't work, that ultimately the thing that will come out of it will be something much, much better than what we've had. The question is, what is that thing going to be?
Doug McLennan is an arts journalist who founded and runs artsjournal.com. You can get there by going to our website, here-now.org. Doug, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.